Do you want to hear the inside story of the Bundy Ranch? Does the political party make any difference? How do the elected officials change after getting into office? Join us as we get into these issues and more on this edition of Homefront. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront. I am here today with Matt Shea. He's a representative in the Washington House of Representatives from Spokane Valley, Washington. He got elected in 2009, so he's been there for about 5 years. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks for having me on, Cynthia. I really appreciate it, and thank you for everything that you're doing in the cause of freedom and liberty.
Well, we both were elected to the legislature. I got there a few years before you. I was elected in 2002, and you were, it says, elected in 2009. I probably had 6 years on you there. But you're an attorney, so that trumps all else. So we both...
There are attorneys on the good side, there are.
Yeah, thank you. We both were elected to the legislature to represent the Republican Party. One difference between us is that you are serving in the minority and I was in the majority. So how's that working out for you being in the minority?
Well, we actually, very interestingly, have had a success this last year in the minority, as interesting as that sounds. And I've always maintained that leadership is not the ability to compromise, it's the ability not to, the ability to bring people over to your point of view and articulate the principles in such a way that people will come to your point of view. And we've been able to very successfully do that. We're in a 6-vote minority in the Washington State House of Representatives. In the Washington State Senate, we have a 1-vote majority, so we're able to get things... We're able to get it out of the House. We can get it through the Senate almost always, with a few exceptions. But we've really gone on the offense here in Washington State with what we call the Freedom Agenda. We decided, you know, that they have their agendas for positive change and agendas for abortion and agendas 21, an agenda for this and that, and we said, well, why don't we have an agenda for freedom? And so we introduced it in Washington State, 65 bills, and we have had the most successful slate of conservative bills in Washington State in over 20 years by having this plan, creating an activist network of over 75,000 throughout the state of Washington via the internet and Facebook and social media. And out of those 65 bills that we introduced, under the banner of lower taxes, less government, and more freedom, we had 42 hearings. Maybe we get one or two. We got 32 passed out of the House or the Senate. We got 12 signed into law without a veto by the governor of Washington, who is a very liberal governor. And one of those bills actually bans Sharia law in specialty courts in Washington State. So I think we've been very, very successful going on the offense. And there's a great principle, I think, to be learned that if we can do this in Washington State, we can do it anywhere in the country.
I guess the lesson learned is it really doesn't matter what party you're with. I mean, in Missouri, let me tell you what it's like there. When I got elected, my class was the one where the majority changed from being the Democrat majority to the Republican majority. So when we got up there, we had high hopes we were going to correct all the wrongs of the world, and we had 48 years of Democrat control of the House, and it was time for us to sweep the place clean. That didn't really happen. And why it didn't is because the Democrats, they got legislation passed. I guess in Washington State, even though you have the Democrats in charge, they are working so well that they're letting Republicans get bills passed. When I was in the House and the Republicans were in charge, I guess you could say the same thing. They let Democrat bills pass. Nevertheless, what are we doing to ourselves now? How does that work for you? And are you giving up things to get that? I know in Missouri, they wanted to have a couple Democrats vote with them on bills, and so they gave them nice offices and nice parking places. How does it work for you guys?
Well, you know, I've guarded against that. I was warned about that before I ever got into office. As a Christian, a Bible-believing Christian, you know, you just guard yourself against that going over there. And what I believed in when I got on the ground was that the principles of freedom and liberty crossed party lines. It was a non-party issue. It was an American issue. And so that's the way we approached it, and we built coalitions around these issues that we believed we could find folks on the Democrat side of the aisle that would agree with us. And they might not agree with us on any other issue, but they agree with us on restricting the use of drones. So great. We work with them on that issue, and we do a bill called the Constitutional Use of Drones in Washington State, and we get it all the way through the House and the Senate. Unfortunately, our liberal governor vetoed the bill. However, he put a 15-month moratorium on drones. Just one example of where we found we could work on an issue like that and build a coalition around an issue and bring people together around that principle of freedom and move the ball forward. It's not to say that that's on every issue, but it was on enough issues where we got 12 bills passed in the last two years, and got those signed into law. So that's kind of how we approached it. We had a bill to legalize industrial hemp. Hemp is not marijuana. Washington State used to be one of the largest exporters of hemp in the entire world. Huge new market, new jobs for Washington State, and that we were able to work with Democrats to get that through the House of Representatives, and unfortunately was about 5 minutes away from getting through the Senate and got killed. But those are just a couple examples, and we've had many, many pro-business bills that we've got through that reduce regulation dramatically. Where we could find agreement with Democrats, particularly on the issue of food freedom, and I can talk more about that here in a bit.
Well, let me ask you this. Because I was in the majority party, I was able to be appointed to chair the Children and Families Committee, so this gave me a great amount of power because I had my hand on the faucet of all the legislation that came through my committee. So I pushed the pro-life bills, the pro-family bills, pro-taxpayer bills, made sure they had a public hearing. On the other hand, you have to watch the Democrats run the show. They get to push their agenda bills. Is that frustrating for you to just be a committee member?
Well, it is a little frustrating at times, absolutely. And we, even in a six-vote minority, we're able to strategize and put amendments. And as you know, it's easier to kill a bill than it is to pass it. You know, and put amendments on things like gun control and kill gun control in Washington State. But we also went on the offense. And I firmly believe we have as Republicans, we have got to go on the offense. And I hate saying the word Republican because it's really not that even. We are Americans. We believe in the Constitution. We believe in upholding the Constitution. We've got to go on the offense and not be afraid of our own shadow. I think that happens so often, especially among Republicans in the establishment, that they're afraid of their own shadow. They totally capitulate, and then we end up going backwards. And so we went on the offense on the abortion issue. And I don't know if you knew, Cynthia, but Washington State actually legalized abortion before Roe v. Wade. We legalized it via initiative. So we have been a state that has led, unfortunately, on this horrible, horrible issue of killing babies in the womb. And we said, hey, let's defund Planned Parenthood in Washington State. Well, there's no way that could ever pass, right? So we said, well, why don't we use the money for something different? And we defunded Planned Parenthood with an amendment, and we transferred that money to disabled veterans. And we had a vote on the House floor, and we came within four votes of getting that through. We had Democrats that actually joined us on that. So it's kind of those creative things that we try to do where we think we can build a big enough coalition to break the logjam on an issue like abortion, and do those things to really try to stop the killing in Washington State. So that's just another example of how we've tried to work in the minority. And I really firmly believe you don't need to be in a majority to get these things through. You just have to stand for the truth and be able to articulate that in such a way to bring people over to your point of view. And we've been very, very successful at doing that.
Great. Well, you say on your website, other policy areas on which I am focusing include limiting government, protecting access to health care, providing our young people with top-caliber educational opportunities, transportation issues, and addressing the needs of veterans and their families. So I want to know, what are you doing to make this happen? What do you mean when you say you're trying to protect access to health care?
Well, in Washington State, we've been a leader, unfortunately, in the implementation of Obamacare.
So people in Washington don't have access to health care as much as they do here in Missouri?
Well, it's interesting. With the onset of Obamacare and the implementation here in Washington, we have seen tons of businesses have their health care canceled because either their rates have doubled and they can't afford it, or they just simply had the policies canceled. So that's been throughout Washington State. So the answer to your question is probably yes, because we've tried to implement Obamacare here. The solution, of course, is not to try to fix Obamacare. It's going to cost approximately $30 billion over the next 10 years to implement in Washington State alone, according to the Washington Policy Center. No way we can pay for that. Our current budget is $32 billion, so there's just no way we can pay for that. So we introduced a bill to nullify Obamacare in Washington State. And we've also pressed very, very clearly forward to allow other policies from outside Washington State to come in. Right now we have a monopoly in Washington State where there's only four options for health care. Until Obamacare came in, there were only four options for health care. So the answer to your question is yes, we are limited, and there is limited access to health care, and it's because there's been this socialist takeover of health care in Washington, and we've been fighting it, and that's how we've approached that issue.
Are you using that word health care interchangeably with the word insurance?
No, I try to be very, very precise in my wording. So access to health care means very clearly, at least in my mind, localizing, decentralizing, deregulating, and allowing people to either have a health insurance savings account or to allow them access to insurance. So I do not use that interchangeably, and forgive me if it sounded like I did.
No, that's okay. We're just clarifying. You're a lawyer, so words are important. I know that. So you say that one of your goals is to create top-caliber educational opportunities. How are you doing that?
Well, it's very interesting. We've been fighting Common Core here in Washington State. We seem to be one of these experiment states for liberal ideas. Common Core has really two parts to it, two components. The first component is the centralization of curriculum. The second component is the increased tracking and compilation of data on kids to create a central database so that, you know, you pull Sally's ponytail in kindergarten and that's going to be part of your file for the rest of your life. And this real push to centralize data as well has been something we've been fighting. So it's really taken two parts. So when I say top caliber education, what I mean is the decentralization of education locally so that we have local control over curriculum. We do not have these invasions of privacy with databases. One of the things we were able to do this year is we were able to negotiate an education bill that delayed the implementation of Common Core, got rid of the senior class project requirement in Washington State, which was part of Common Core, and we are working with Democrats actually across the aisle to get rid of high-stakes testing, which has been a very central piece of Common Core, and we have a lot of Democrats that support the idea of getting rid of this high-stakes testing and decentralizing and putting it back down locally. So That's what I mean by that, and that's what we've been able to do. And again, we're doing this in Washington State, where we delayed the implementation of part of Common Core. The other thing we introduced was a bill to require that parents know what data is going into these databases, and where we can, we've been introducing amendments to bills to stop the input of data into these databases. So it's been kind of a comprehensive approach to just stopping it and throwing up roadblocks wherever we can, where we have this data compilation on our students in Washington State. So those are the two prongs of that education piece that we have been taking on.
Are any of these your bills?
They're all part of the Freedom Agenda, and yes, I've co-sponsored most of them.
Okay.
But we always shift authors among our group of five members of the House representatives that are part of our Freedom Team, and so, yeah, that's how we handle it.
Did you organize the five members?
I did.
Cool going. Good going. So you also said you're doing something for the needs of veterans. How are you helping the veterans?
Well, so there's some very creative things that we've done, and I'll just give you two examples. So in Washington State, motorcycle conversion kits were illegal, and a conversion kit is something you bolt onto the back of a motorcycle that adds two wheels to it, so it ends up being a four-wheeled vehicle. Well, if it's a four-wheeled vehicle, it was illegal on our roads if it was under a certain size and there was some other over-regulation there. So we just simply legalized these conversion kits for our disabled veterans so that those that rode motorcycles prior to going to Afghanistan or Iraq and they came back and were disabled because maybe they lost a leg or maybe their injuries prevented them from walking correctly and riding a motorcycle correctly, we could put these conversion kits on these motorcycles and get these veterans back out on the road. So that was one specific example. The other specific example is we went after our ATV use in Washington State. And let me specify what I mean by that. In Washington State, the Forest Service, a lot of people probably don't know Missouri, but Washington State, we have over 40% of our land owned and controlled by the federal government and also by the state government. And these entities, Department of Ecology, EPA, BLM, Forest Service, they're all locking this land down so people can't use it. And so we introduced, and I authored the bill, to open up thousands of miles of ATV, or road use to ATVs, including on our county roads. And what that had the effect of doing is opening up the Forest Service roads, because the Forest Service had in their policy that if the county opens a road up, they will abide by that county ordinance. So we just said, okay, fine. We opened up all the county roads, and then that opened up the Forest Service roads to thousands of miles of ATV use. And so we got that bill through and signed into law by the governor, and that was extremely important for our veterans. I'm a 10-year Army veteran. I served two combat tours overseas in Bosnia and Iraq, and it's important to get veterans outdoors and back in the forest when they come back to help them kind of readjust to things. And I thought, why not? What a great way to not only expand freedom but help our veterans. So those are a couple of very specific examples of things that we've done to help.
Was there a fiscal note attached to that bill?
There was a fiscal note, and there was an economic impact regarding that particular bill. And the economic impact was estimated to be between $50 and $100 million over the next 10 years in rural Washington. And as most rural places in the United States, that really has been impoverished, the rural areas of Washington, by all the overregulation. So that was really important, just the economic impact. The fiscal note was because these ATVs were being allowed on the roads, they were put under the exact same requirements and category as motor vehicles, so because they would be on our county highways, and that is why there was a fiscal impact to it.
So you're thinking that you're going to make a bundle of revenue off of people who will now want to get a license? I heard how much you charge for your licenses, and folks, you really ought to be ashamed of yourself. But aside from that, you you're just thinking these ATV folks are all going to want to register their vehicles and you'll get a windfall from that?
No, that wasn't where I was coming from. Actually, the tax revenue, any tax revenue, most of the tax revenue that would be generated from the sales of ATVs, from the sales of food, from the sales of hotel rooms, et cetera, for these folks going into rural Washington to use these ATV trails. Right now, most people don't even ride in Washington State. They go to Montana or Idaho or Oregon to ride. So the impact that I'm talking about, the economic impact, is in a private sector and would be generated based on these ATVs staying in Washington State and using our roads and trails in Washington.
Okay, so somebody's on the ATV, and he suddenly says, I only wish I could go to a McDonald's right now. or a motel. So then they
would allow them to go, yeah.
Put their money into your economy. I get that. Hi, friends. Do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. My website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net. Hey, let's stay in touch. Tell us about your show that you produce. It's called The Way I See It. Do you produce it yourself, or do you walk into a studio and you have paid staff who does all that for you?
I do produce that myself. It's a commentary, one-minute commentary that is aired 5 times a day, every day on American Christian Network, which is broadcast throughout all of Eastern Washington. The other thing that I do is a weekly radio show, half-hour radio show called Battlefront, which is aired on Tuesday mornings at 8:30 on ACN. And ACN, American Christian Network, is streamed also on the Internet, and it is a huge network in Eastern Washington. We're very fortunate to have it. And the station owner is a true patriot and good friend. So
do you pay for your airtime, or they do it just to be nice to you?
No, I do pay for my airtime, and we use several different ways. You know, you have donors that give you money to do that, but also some of it comes from campaign funds as well during campaigns.
So when do you have time to be a lawyer? I mean, you think about all your billable hours that you're not charging people for. This takes a lot of time, effort, and energy. How do you fit that all in?
Well, I work probably 16 to 18 hours a day, every day, without exaggeration there. And, you know, my lovely and wonderful wife is very understanding and supportive of what I'm trying to do, and that's really how I try to fit it in. I just be very disciplined in my schedule and just make it happen. So
now that you've been there 5 years, you've seen plenty of people change. One of the greatest disappointments for the whole 8 years I was in the legislature is I saw people come motivated altruistically. They really wanted to do the right thing. And then I watched them change. I saw people having affairs and divorces, and the guys who came there all clean cut were smoking cigars and playing poker in the back room. My question is, how has being there changed you? With all the people, generally, they shift to the left. They start off more conservative, and then they, the longer they're there, the more they really don't care about much. How do you fight that in your life, and what has it done to you? What kind of tempering has occurred in the years you've been there?
Well, you know, there's something that I firmly believe in, and that's that the Lord will place you where He wants you if you're available to what He wants you to do. And so I prayed and thought about when I was asked to run for office, whether I should even do it. So when it was pretty clear that I should run for office, after doing that prayer and thought and fasting, I got into office. I then asked the Lord, well, what do you want me to do now? You got me here. And I tried to keep that prayer at the forefront every single day. Lord, what do you want me to do? And I think by doing that and, you know, asking the Lord, which is the hardest prayer to pray, but asking the Lord for humility, because He will humble you, it really keeps you on the right path for Him. How being in the legislature has changed me, I realized that a lot of Americans just have no idea how absolutely corrupt both parties are, not just Democrats, but how corrupt Republicans are, and how Republican leadership will intentionally not do the right thing sometimes because they want to maintain power and control. That realization and seeing that changed me greatly in the way that I approach things, and specifically that when I approach things, I made sure that I had a plan, I had a team put together, and then we worked the plan together, because it was a lot easier to work together with God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving Christian legislators, you know, against that machine instead of trying to do it all by myself. So that really changed me, just seeing how corrupt it was. It also reaffirmed to me how important it was to read the Bible every day, to pray with my wife every day, to pray, you know, alone every day, and really seek that guidance and make sure that I was following Him, and if there needed to be a course correction, to take it, because He didn't want me to fall into a trap. And then the last thing I would say is, people say, well, what are you going to do next? Are you going to run for Congress? Are you going to do this? Are you going to run for, you know, Attorney General? What are you going to do? And I really tried not to have any ambition whatsoever for any higher office or other office, because I felt like, and I firmly believe this, that selfish ambition really was the greatest pitfall. When I saw those, the same people that you mentioned, start out on a great track and then fall by the wayside, it was usually selfish ambition that was what tripped them up. So I tried to guard strongly against that and just go where the Lord led.
That's a great message for everybody in every career. When I was in the legislature, I had an opportunity to get involved in many issues, and I went even to California to be a plaintiff in a lawsuit to question Barack Obama's legitimacy to hold office. And you recently went down to Nevada to stand with the Bundys. So if I were in office, I would have joined you. I actually was talking with a friend from Washington State, and when he told me you were going to Nevada, I'm like, oh, I would love to go. Let me go. I would relish every mile driving there just to be part of making a difference and standing for principles. So let me ask you about your trip to Nevada, and how did you manage to learn from that, and how did you help the situation by being there?
Well, in Nevada, let me back up. We had a phone conference on a Wednesday night between myself, Sheriff Richard Mack, and Stuart Rhodes of Oathkeepers. And we came to the conclusion, based on the real-time intelligence we were getting from the ground there, that this situation was escalating and likely was going to turn into another Waco or another Ruby Ridge. And so we decided amongst ourselves that it would be behoove us to head down there to prevent that from happening, but at the same time take it as an opportunity to educate the American people on what was really going on, and why the Bundys were right to stand against the federal government. And so we went down there to Nevada, and for your listeners, as I'm a constitutional attorney, I'm admitted to practice in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, so I'm not talking out of school here. The Bundys had water rights to that land. They have water rights to that land. And in another case in Nevada regarding the same BLM, the same Forest Service, during the same time period in the same state, U.S. v. Wayne Hage, Federal Court Judge Robert Jones ruled that when you have a water right, you have a corresponding right of forage for your cattle within a certain radius around that water right. In that case, U.S. v. Hage, he said it was a half mile around each watering hole. So his whole thing about grazing and him not paying the grazing fees really was irrelevant in some respects because he already had a forage right. He had a vested, preemptive, adjudicated water right, which means that he was first in time, first in right, which is a preemptive right in Western water law, which means you are the last person in the line to have your water shut off if water needs to be shut off. The second thing, adjudicated, means you've gone before a court and it has been certified how much water you can take for stock watering of your cattle, which you keep, virtually is unchangeable once you get it adjudicated. So he had the most solid right under the law that he could possibly have, and then he had it recognized in another court of competent jurisdiction in Nevada, just another county, that there's a corresponding forage right. So this whole thing about grazing and grazing fees and everything is really kind of a red herring. But that said, the grazing fee issue is interesting because if he would have paid his grazing fees, he would have acknowledged the BLM's authority to reduce his cattle herd from 900 to 150 cattle, which would have completely destroyed his operation, which is and was their intent. So the other part is he did actually try to pay his grazing fees to the county government because he said that the BLM wasn't using the grazing fees to manage the watering tanks. What does that mean? That means keeping up the watering tanks and the fences and everything. They were instead using the grazing fees to buy out the other ranchers from their property rights. So they were violating their own charter, BLM was, weren't even managing the land. They were using the money to kick people off the land. So from a legal perspective, I think, the Bundys had a great case, and I think they did the right thing in standing up against that tyranny. What's interesting is in U.S. v. Hage, in that case, that federal judge, Robert Jones, went on to say this, and this was not put out in the media. He went on to say that the BLM and the Forest Service, and these are his words, not Matt Shea's, these are his words, BLM and the Forest Service were engaged in a, quote, 20-year conspiracy, a literal conspiracy, end quote, to deprive the Hages of their property rights. And he then went on to charge them, or at least make the charges, that they were engaged in racketeering, extortion, and mail fraud. So this is the same BLM, same Forest Service, same time period, same subject matter, same state, just a different county. What changed with the Bundys? We never heard that in the media. So that's kind of the other side of the story there. And then last, I would just say, Cynthia, that the federal government was actually operating outside the law. Very clearly, there is a federal statute that says the BLM and Congressman Steve Stockman, to his great credit, brought this forward to the public, that when the BLM is doing an enforcement action, they must rely on local law enforcement to the greatest extent possible. That did not happen in this case, and therefore they were in direct violation of federal law. To add to that, with the court order, it said seize the cattle. It didn't say destroy the stock water tanks. It didn't say kill the cattle, it said seize the cattle, yet the BLM went in there, destroyed the stock water tank, part of them, and then killed 16 of the cattle. One bull in particular, a prize bull, was shot from a helicopter, so clearly it wasn't a threat to anybody, and they dug a mass grave for those cattle that was big enough not just for the 16 they killed, but for the 300 that they had captured. So that kind of gives you an insight into the federal government there. Aside from everything that happened with the protesters, and the last thing I would say is that a sniper rifle is not due process. And those veterans that were a part of that, they took an oath to the Constitution of the United States of America, and they did not take an oath to point sniper rifles at American citizens. That's just reprehensible, in my opinion.
Did you end up solving any problem by your presence?
Well, we did. And when we stopped, they knew that we were headed down there. They knew there were elected officials on the ground, and that made them think twice, and I think it was one of the huge reasons that they backed off. One of the other positives that came out of everything on the ground was we formed a coalition of Western states. You got to love that acronym, COWS. We formed a coalition of Western states, and we now have over 8 states and 30 legislators that are a part of it, so that if this happens again, which it will, we can have a coordinated response to it. But more importantly, we can go on the offense and preempt this from happening on land throughout the rest of the West. And so that was a huge positive that came out of this, absolutely.
Is the BLM going to be paying the Bundys for the damages they did to their property?
As I understand it, the Bundys were in discussions with attorneys that were forming a team of legal minds to help them, and the answer is yes. I think they will be claiming that against the BLM, so whatever offset and damages at the end of the case, because the case isn't over yet, will be taken into account, because very clearly the BLM did violate that court order.
I was listening to Jay Sekulow discuss some of the abuses of this administration, and he explained that what we're watching is the Obama administration going way off the edge of what's normal or legal behavior. Then we catch them, call them on it, say that was wrong. They apologize and back down, and then they still have a net gain of 20%. So they back down off of, I'm talking about the IRS harassment of Tea Party groups. I'm talking about the FCC, where they threaten to go into radio stations and ask what's on their agenda and how do they decide what the content of the shows should be. There are many examples of where our federal government has overstepped itself. I wonder if you believe that they're doing it on purpose to soften us up so that when they retreat partially and they still have a net gain for the next time. What is going to happen to America if they keep flagrantly abusing their rights?
Well, there is no question in my mind that this is intentional. None whatsoever. And what should alarm and concern every American was that someone in the federal government gave the order to fire on and detain American citizens at the Bundy Ranch. Let me be very specific about what I mean. At that Saturday morning when everything came to a culmination, there were armored vehicles headed toward the Bundy Ranch. The State Patrol was headed there. The BLM had automatic weapons that were pointed at American citizens, and every indicator we had was that they were getting ready to fire on those American citizens, in addition to the fact that they were bringing prison detention buses up there to the scene. So there is no question this was intentional. There is no question they were trying to make an example of the Bundys. There is no question that somebody had given that order. And I don't think this is the end. And this is not by any stretch an isolated incident. This is happening all over the West, whether you're talking the Sackett family in North Idaho, you're talking Bill Demers with the Department of Ecology in Washington State and Eastern Washington, you're talking about New Mexico, Red River, and Texas-Oklahoma border. This has happened all over the country. So, yes, it is intentional, and everybody needs to understand that they are looking for the next event, the next situation that they can use to exploit this, to not only soften the American people up, but do something even worse, I think, and that's to make the American people afraid so they self-censor, which is the worst kind of tyranny.
It is the worst kind because it makes us afraid to speak up and speak out. Even though we know that we still have some rights, when people go over their authority and use their authority to harass and intimidate us, then you find that around the Thanksgiving table, people are afraid to talk about such things anymore. It used to be we could learn from each other. If people are quiet, then they have won the debate. So what are we going to do next? Are you feeling like you have a new agenda going? You did most of your freedom agenda last year. What is going to happen next session?
Well, first I want to say, that I'm going to call it what it is, what happened and what is happening with the federal government. That's bureaucratic terrorism. And one of the big agenda items we have going forward with the Coalition of Western States is we need to disarm the federal bureaucrats, period. That has got to happen. We have to demilitarize them because they are literally terrorizing American citizens. The second part of that is we need to transfer land back from the federal government to the states. Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution makes it very clear that if the federal government didn't A, purchase the land, and B, didn't use it for dockyards, military forts, needful buildings, Navy yards, that is not an appropriate ownership of land for the federal government. So Ken Ivory with the American Lands Council has done a great job at outlining the legal case for transferring land back to the states. That's something we have to do, especially in the West. The next thing is once we transfer that land back to the states, we need to sell it to private entities, as is required by the enabling acts of most of the Western states. The third thing that's very important is at the local level, we've been educating and need to continue to educate county commissioners on their ability to create land management plans at the local level and then demand coordination with the federal government, which puts a brake on everything that the federal government agencies are trying to do, the EPA, BLM. When they come in and try to affect any land use in that county, county commissioners can say, we have a land use plan, we've already demanded coordination, you must abide by our plan. And that puts the control back at the local level. The whole coordination process is laid out by AmericanStewards.org. Some great, great folks. William Perry Penley has talked about it among many, many other people, but American Stewards is the really place to go for that issue. And then I also believe that we have to decentralize to the very local level, to the county level. And that also means that the county commissioners need to pass resolutions backing their sheriffs up. When the sheriff demands that the federal government, if they're going to do any sort of law enforcement action in that county, must come through the sheriff. They already have to. But I think it's important that resolution gets passed so that it's public and formal. Those county commissioners are going to back the sheriff in that instance. Because really the county sheriff is kind of that last stand at the local level against tyranny besides the well-armed people.
Sounds good. Is there one last point you want us to take home when we think about Matt Shea?
Well, I just would put forward this lesson, that if we stand united as Americans on principle, we don't waver, we don't back down, we win. And we just have to go on the offense and not be afraid of these principles of freedom and liberty. And if you want more information about me, you can go to Matt Shea on Facebook. You can check out my website at voteshea.com. I have a lot of this stuff and links on both places. And you can also check out Freedom Agenda Washington on Facebook and check out our template for how we put it together in Washington State, and maybe you can use it in your state with your own state legislator.
Sounds like a great plan. Well, thank you for being with us, Matt. You are a fountain of wisdom. It's a pleasure and a delight to get to glean a few droplets from all your endeavors. You're doing a great job. Will you be on our show again sometime?
Absolutely, Cynthia. Look forward to it. Appreciate everything you're doing in the cause of freedom and liberty.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.